Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Us 50 Years to Learn, Shortcuts to Excellence, where we dispense wisdom, not mere information or just fact, to an international audience of rising leaders. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. This podcast is sponsored by Professional Development Forum, which helps young professionals of any age accelerate their performance in the modern workforce. Today, you'll hear honest, practical advice that you cannot find in a textbook because it took us 50 years to learn this stuff. Our guest today is Matt Bay. Matt, is it Bay or Bay? First of all, that's my first question.
It's Bay, but I like the fact that I'm in writing, so nobody can know that for sure. But
I've always said Bay, and then somebody said it's Bay. I said, no, it's Bay. I know the guy. Matt Bay is an American journalist, author, screenwriter. He's a one-man media conglomerate is what it comes down to. But he didn't start that way. He's the former chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, the former national political columnist for Yahoo News. He's currently a contributing columnist to the Washington Post. And dig this is my favorite. You know that TV show, House of Cards? Matt portrayed himself twice on that show. So there you go. He is one of the nation's, the U.S.'s leading political voices on American politics. And I've been reading your columns for years, Matt, because you cogently, lucidly describe what's going on in the U.S. political scene. And that's not easy. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Duff. I appreciate that. And it's great to see you again. And it's a great idea for a podcast. I love it.
Thank you. Appreciate the guy. I and the guys appreciate it. Oh, before I want to plug your book because this is important to history. Now, this is Matt's book, All the Truth is Out. Now, the reason I'm holding up this cheesy piece of paper is because I loaned my book to a friend of mine and he hasn't given it back yet. So if you see this podcast, call me, all right? We need to talk. All the Truth is Out. And this is the version that I saw. Now, it has since been made into a movie, which is called The Front Runner, starring Australia's Hugh Jackman. Now, Matt, has the book been re-released as this title as well?
Yeah, there's like 3,000 versions of the book now. You know, I co-wrote the movie, so I actually came up with the title The Front Runner as well, but then because they want to call it All the Truth is Out, then they retitled my book The Front Runner, which is, it's kind of like somebody coming into your house and renaming your kid, you know? Rename my book. So now I've got you can buy All the Truth is Out, you can buy The Front Runner, you can buy The Front Runner British or Australian editions or others. So I've just
Can I get a t-shirt as well?
I'm starting to think I got more versions than readers, but I don't know.
Well, readers, this was whatever, I rose by any other name. This book was one of the 2014's year's best. But the reason I'm pushing this hard is because if you want to understand how American politics devolved into the cheesy, chintzy, tabloid version that it is now, instead of the sophisticated, intelligent, erudite version that I kind of grew up with, that book explains it all. One more time, All the Truth is Out. And I actually lived during that, so it struck quite a chord with me. Let me ask you a couple of questions before we delve into your 10 lessons. Now, you've been writing a long time, and that's your job.
I've been writing a long time.
Do you remember your first, call it business lesson?
Yeah, I mean, oh boy. You know, I've had a few. I mean, you know, writing, the thing about writing is you're not in business, but you're your own business, particularly now, you know, even more than when I started. So, you know, I had some, you know, there are some difficult bumps along the way in learning to look out for yourself. And writers by nature, we're not very good at, it's funny, I'm a lawyer's kid, but we're not very good at representing ourselves. We're not very good at standing up for ourselves. We're not business people generally. So I'll tell you, when I was in my early 30s or around, I got what I, you know, I was working at Newsweek and I got my dream job, what I thought was my dream job at Rolling Stone, you know, the old Hunter Thompson job, right? Who didn't want that? And I signed a big contract and I quit my job happily. And I went to work at Rolling Stone. And while I was getting ready to go to Rolling Stone, they did a bunch of focus groups and decided they didn't want to do politics anymore. So I got there and it became apparent that they didn't really have much use for me anymore. And then finally, some guy called me up. He said, I answered the front of my desk. He said, I'm the general manager of Rolling Stone. And I work for Jan Wenner, and I don't know why no one's told you, but you just don't have a job anymore. you got to leave. And I said, well, yeah, but I just signed a contract. And he said, well, I don't really think of that as a contract. I think of that as more like a set of expectations. I'm pretty sure a lawyer's going to think it's a contract. And he said, well, then fine, have your lawyer call me. And he hung up. And I went to deposit my last paycheck and they had stopped payment on it. And what I learned in that very painful experience, because I had no money at the time and now I had no job and not even a paycheck, was that was not to represent myself. What was to let experts be experts and have ever since then, I've always had agents and lawyers take care of. I don't do the business side. I had a conversation just this morning with somebody that started to get into a Hollywood thing where they started to get into, well, benchmarks in the deal. And I said, I don't do that. Like, I'm not saying I don't do that because I need somebody to come in and be a heavy. I don't do that because I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I turn that over. So I guess that's a long way of saying I learned to do what I do best and know what I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think knowing what you don't know is a critical part of not making stupid mistakes.
Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that you learned it the hard way, didn't have a job, canceled they stopped payment on your check. Didn't have any money, of course, because which is actually it's unusual because most writers are rolling in money, right? I mean, isn't that what I'm led to believe?
Well, you'd be surprised. Yeah. Sometimes to be a writer, you got to have, you know, people figure they got to have some cushion already. I do.
Yeah, you got to love it. People don't write for money, as I know well. No. Okay, so that's all right. That's a good lesson to learn. So that was your experience into the world of commerce. What about my second question? What have you unlearned maybe lately? And by that I mean something you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now you realize not the case.
I mean, it's funny, as a reporter, if you're a good reporter, and I was a newspaper reporter when I was younger, you learn to unlearn things a lot because news is very humbling and you always think you know what happened and then you find out you didn't know what happened. So I feel like I've spent an entire career unlearning things. I will tell you this though, when I was young, and I mean by young, I mean in my 20s, you know, out of college, if I could go back, right? Another way to ask this question, if I could go back and say to my 22-year-old mm-hmm. self, you know, you're wrong. I was in a hurry. You know, I put a lot of premium on getting there fast. Mm-hmm. I knew what I wanted to do and wasn't very patient about it. And, you know, I wanted a forum. And fortunately for me, in whatever we're talking about, the early 1990s, right? There weren't blogs and there weren't websites you could set up for yourself. You had to go through the traditional institutions, the gatekeepers, and mm-hmm. nobody was going to let me vent all my opinions or try to get attention any way I wanted, or, you know, try and get that success really fast. I had to go through certain stations and I still moved pretty quickly. But what I realize now, and the mistake I see people make is, you know, it's not, the time really isn't as critical as it seems to you when you're young.
Mm-hmm.
A year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 5 years of your career goes by in your 20s, you don't even remember it later.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is getting where you really want to go and getting there and having the building blocks and learning how to do things and keeping your self-respect. And I feel very fortunate that I did not have the ability to just go on cable TV or go on a blog. And I watched colleagues of mine through their, you know, later through their 20s and their 30s, go for I still do, if I turn on the TV, you know, go for a kind of what I consider a kind of cheap fame or a cheap success,
mm-hmm.
right? Get booked on shows all day long or have a clever tweet and, you know, try to be looked at, try to be noticed. Sometimes you have to. I mean, there's some of that, and probably necessary in this environment, but there are ways to be successful and ways to be famous that are better than other ways. They're not all the same. And mm-hmm. if you do it the wrong way, I think it's very hard to come back from that. I think mm-hmm. if you're not taken seriously, it's very hard to rebuild that gravitas. And part of why I've had the success I had as a magazine writer and an author, I think, was that people knew I took my role, my job, my mission seriously. And I wasn't just trying to get attention. And I wasn't just trying to get the thing that would get me out there. I wanted it the right way. And I think doing it the right way is more important than doing it fast. And I didn't know that when I was young. And it was only pure faith that enabled me to learn that lesson.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that's a very good point. By the way, listeners, viewers, you can subscribe to Matt's columns. I'm not sure how I did it, but I know one can do it. And I do know that it's worthwhile because it's not just clickbait. That's not the good stuff. Matt writes the good stuff. So how does one subscribe to your column?
I appreciate it. You can, two ways. I mean, you can obviously go to the Washington Post, although I guess there is no subscription button for that right now. But you can go to my website, mattbye.com, and there's a newsletter. There's a sign up right there on the front, and then you get emails with the column. You do have to be able to log into the Post, so there is a small subscription fee. I get emails from writers like every week saying, why do I have to pay to read your column? And I would say, because really good journalism is expensive, and the Washington Post is an excellent news site. And mm-hmm. And and what they do isn't free. You can't go into a bookstore and pocket the book that you want under your arm and walk out, can you? So you can't do that with news either. But it's pretty reasonable, especially for the first year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. So So mattbye.com is one way of doing it. That's how I do it. Let's progress to the 10 lessons it took you 50 years to learn. Lesson number one: life is in the rewrite.
Yeah, this is something I say to my kids all the time. They're really sick of hearing it. I've been saying since they were like 2 years old. That's all. Every time someone's going to say life is in the rewrite, which is really another way of saying, you know, if at first you don't succeed. But I, you know, I relate. Look, the whole premise of my list that I, you know, is I've given you is what I have found over the years as a writer is that things that make sense in writing make sense in life. There's a lot of overlap between writing well and living smart or the things you learn in both. And, you know, when you're young and people tell you, write it again, you know, this is okay. But now we want, you know, especially a magazine where they go through, you know, very heavily, you get your back up, you know, and you know, but I wrote it beautifully and I labored over this and I labored over this paragraph or this word. But the truth is, you know, I learned to embrace the rewrite part. I care more about the second draft than the first. I don't care much about the first draft other than that you think I'm basically in the right direction. But I do pride myself on being able to nail that second draft because that's what life is. It is in the rewrite. It is, everything is not about doing everything, getting everything right the first time or intuiting everything you need to do yourself. It's about listening to people, hearing what you're getting right and getting wrong, and being able to self-correct and improve and learn new things. And that is, I think, a key to both success and happiness. So for me, everything in life is about the rewrite and not about the first draft. And it's something I'm trying with limited success to teach my kids.
Give them time. When I read that, life is in the rewrite, it made me think of the Hollywood saying. And as you know, because you deal with Hollywood, in Hollywood, nothing is written, everything is rewritten. And my interpretation of that is, you know, it's a collaboration. And I write too, and you learn the hard way that the editor has a different view. And you stop being precious about it. And then when you realize that they're actually right, you know, they actually have a good idea. You remember the movie, The Fisher King, written and directed by Richard LaGrivenzi or something like that?
Was John Goodman in that movie? I thought it was.
Robin Williams was, but I remember Richard, the director writer, he said, because the way the filmed version is very different than this actual basic story, but he says something that as a writer you need to learn, and in life there's always a better version, there's always a better way, there's always a better ending.
Just this morning I spent probably an hour on the phone with a famous director on a script, and it was hard. It's a script I wrote myself. It's you know, it's largely autobiographical, and you know, it was page by page of cuts and changes. And you know, when I was in my 20s, say, I would have taken that as a kind of criticism. I would have taken it well, but inside I would have been thinking, I failed. You know, I put a lot of pressure on myself. But I, you know, you come to learn that. You come to get excited about it, actually. You come to start, I was getting really amped up and I dove right into it when I got off the phone because you started thinking, I can make this better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big key to life is knowing you can get better at things. The thing I love about screenwriting is that it's new for me and I get better every time I do it. Not that I couldn't get better at magazines or books, but I got pretty good at it. And this is a skill that I don't know, and or that I didn't know a couple of years ago. And then I'm every project, every conversation, I learn something new. And that is, constantly learning to improve oneself is, I don't think you can have a really fulfilling life or career without it. It's not just career, it's life. Cause try being married and not being able to, you know, accept that you do things wrong the first time, and it'll be tough.
Mm-hmm. I am trying being married, and what you very rapidly learn is that other person is an authority on your behavior, whether you like it or not. And I get constant stream of very helpful feedback, Matt, which is
right.
As my wife sneeringly said to me one time, I am going to improve you.
See, now that's great. You should say fantastic. Life's in the rewrite.
This was liberating. This was a great burden off my mind, because I've been engaged in self-improvement for a long time, so I could just relax now. So she's in control, and I'm the better for it, let me tell you. Point number two, there is no such thing as aberrant behavior.
Yeah, I just don't. I guess the other way of putting that is, I give people this advice all the time. I guess all of my advice, as opposed to like business, is either good for writing or dating, you know? And when I say there's no such thing as aberrant behavior, I guess I mean, it's good both for interacting and dating in life, and you know, that, but it's also an important thing, I think, for a reporter to understand, or somebody who's seeking the truth, which is that nobody's ever doing anything for the first time, and they're never doing anything for the last time. If they were cheating on someone when they met you, they're going to cheat on you eventually. If anybody ever says to me like, "Oh, I did lie. I lied about that, but I've never lied about that before." That's not true, and it won't be true in the future. So that's the general rule I go by, is nothing ever happens once, and nobody ever does anything once, and then that gives you, I think, a pretty good window into, you know, who people are and what the world is going to look like. So as a reporter, I've always kept that in mind, and I'd keep it in mind in business too.
There is no such thing as aberrant behavior. It reminded me of the French essayist La Rochefoucauld, and I can't remember his exact phrase, but he said he wasn't disgusted or turned off or surprised by anything in human behavior, because that's what humans are like. So, any behavior is human behavior.
I sometimes tell journalists who, if I talk to classes about profiles, I always say, don't tell me that, there's nothing I hate more than picking up a magazine story that tells me somebody is a bundle of contradictions. You might as well tell me they have a nose or ears or they breathe, right? That's humanity. We're all jumbles of contradictions. Your job as a journalist to figure out why, mm-hmm. you know, and so, you know, I think that's just part of humanity, and people do the things they've done before, and they do, and they'll do them again.
Well, I like to quote Marcus Aurelius, the famous philosopher, emperor of Rome, considered one of the best, also a general. He said, I'm going to paraphrase. He would say, how old are you? You're 40 years old? You're older than 40. Okay, you've seen it all. You've seen it all already. Yeah. Now you're just going to keep seeing it over and over again. You've seen everything that life has to offer if you're 40. And so get ready, because here it comes again. And I think that is just spot on, because it's so true.
Yeah, you've seen this movie before, right? That is true.
Lesson number three, listen to the things people say about themselves.
Yeah, I guess it's related to aberrant behavior. But it's something I tell reporters a lot, and when my kids get old enough to date, I'll probably tell them this too. And I think generally, particularly when you meet people, that's when they're most honest about themselves. And people will tell you an awful lot about themselves if you don't discount things because you don't want to believe them or because you're not listening. Mm-hmm. A lot of times when we meet people, I'm sure this is true in business too. A lot of times when we meet people, there's a voice in our heads going, am I sounding okay? Am I coming off well? Am I making a good impression? Right? You go to a job interview and what you're not doing then is listening to what the person is saying to you. The single thing that TV journalists do that drive me crazy, and it's probably all journalists, is they'll show up with a list of questions, they'll read the questions, and they don't listen to the answers. So, you know, they're asking you, a question about something, and the person being interviewed can say, you know, I don't know, I just killed my whole family this morning. And then I go, okay, let me move on to my next question. And they're not, mm-hmm. they're actually not processing anything. So, you know, listening to what people tell you about themselves is really important, because particularly before they have a lot invested and they know you very well, they're very likely to tell you the truth. And if you meet somebody who says to you, you know, gosh, somebody said to me recently, this is the point of the conversation where I usually break my commitment. You know, that person is telling you they're going to break their commitment, right? You know, and I took that seriously, you know, that like sent a flag on it. So I do think most people miss important clues about the people they're meeting and talking to because they don't take seriously what the person says about themselves.
Okay, what about the politicians you cover though? I look at politicians, not just in the U.S., Australia, rarely do I see even a hint of authenticity from these people because they're so guarded and defensive. And I'm not saying, they have some good reasons for it sometimes. They're so buttoned up, buttoned down, confined, scripted. I mean, it's really hard to see authenticity, so it appears to me.
It is. If you're watching interviews on television, it's impossible. But if you do what I've done for a long time, or what I used to do, I don't know how possible it is anymore, actually spend days with politicians, ride in their cars, share a dinner or a drink. You know, they're human beings like everybody else, and they will tell you things about themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, most people, politicians or otherwise, they actually want to talk about the things they're passionate about, and they want to talk about themselves. But most of the time, we're aware that we're either being judged or somebody's not listening. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, key for journalists, and I think it would be very key for CEOs or people who do hiring, if you actually focus on listening and keeping an open mind, I think you can learn a lot. And I always learned a lot about politicians I was writing about that surprised people. And to me, there was I always ascribe this to Richard Ben Cramer, who was a friend of mine. The late Richard Cramer was a brilliant political writer and profiler of baseball players and everyone else. And, you know, Richard's great talent was to listen. There was no witchery to it, as I say in the introduction of my book. You know, it was it is a very undervalued skill and something most people don't work very hard at either. Mm-hmm. And I'm not perfect. You know, I there are plenty of times where I haven't heard, where I have to go back and listen to a recording of an interview and would realize that, you know, I hadn't caught the thing that was really important at the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes you have to hear the emotional undertone rather than the actual words that are being said. And that takes a bit of practice to develop.
Yeah. And you have to be able to focus and stay in the moment, you know, which is really hard for people. I mean, it's funny. It's a funny thing about my wife. She's more than anyone I've ever met. She's always able to be in the moment. She doesn't mm-hmm. worry about tomorrow. She doesn't dwell on yesterday. It's like, she's right there with you. Most of us, you know, are thinking about the thing that's coming up in an hour or the thing we did 2 hours ago I should have made a note. I have to pick this up or get that done. And you miss a lot in what's happening and what somebody's saying to you right in front of you. And I think that's a learned skill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Point number four, don't fight with someone you don't know. Oh, Matt, where were you? Where were you last week when I got involved with a Facebook feud over politics and Twitter?
What I'm talking about, Duff. This is my point. I really had to learn this, and I think it's important in the social media age, and I've failed on it many times, and I still probably can and some, but it's, you know, you can, in this moment where we live so much of our lives online and we do social media, and I watch my kids go through it and I go through it, it is so possible to get insulted and hurt and caught up in arguments and trying to be right and punching back when you're punched. And, you know, look, those of us who write for a living, we get killed online all the time. And I just, at some point, I used to do it. And at some point I realized you waste a lot of time in your life fighting mm-hmm. with people you don't know. You're never going to meet, you don't know what, it's not just that you don't know if they matter or you don't know if they're smart or you don't know if they have an audience. It's also, you don't know if they're hurting, you don't know if they're damaged. You don't know what drives them to criticize you. It's mm-hmm. probably hard to be that person online who's beating the snot out of you. You know, you don't know who that person is. And so there's a level of empathy to it. And I just think you'll be happier in life and go to sleep happier and sleep better and be better for the people who love you if you don't get angry with people who just don't matter, who just aren't in your field of vision and who you'll never know. And I've distanced myself from social media largely anyway. I do a little bit of Twitter around my column or other things. I don't do Instagram. Mm-hmm. I don't do Facebook really. I have an account, but I mostly just post stuff there. Mm-hmm. But I really try, and I sometimes break the rule. I'm not perfect, but I really try not to let hostilities online or in email or other ways, bleed into my life, because you can't waste your energy doing that.
I can only ascribe it to a sudden massive drop of IQ on my part. You know, I don't normally do this, but the interesting thing, and it's just as you said, I had a lingering sense of upset and anger and hostility, which is harmful, not to anyone else, to me, you know, to the person. And I thought, man, you know, I'm an educated person. I've got a high school diploma and everything. You know, how many times am I going to fall for this? So that's excellent advice. Don't fight with somebody you don't know.
And there was a time, Duff, as a writer where, and look, I've always had my email address out there. I've always been reachable for readers. I never, even in the early days, I never had a dummy address like some people do. Even at the Times, I let my email address up. And it used to be, I felt like if you got back to an angry person online and said, I'm sorry you feel that way, I wish you'd put it differently, or I don't know if you're proud to have written that note about my mother, but you know, let me explain to you what I was doing. You know, 7-8 times out of 10, you'd get a note back saying, I didn't think you'd really read this, or I appreciate that you replied, or you're right, mm-hmm. let me rephrase it. You could come to an understanding. I took a lot of satisfaction from that. Mm-hmm. But not, you know, not convincing people that I was right, but convincing them that I was a human being and I had appreciation for what they were saying, and they could have appreciation for me. I think that's very hard now. I think that's very rare. People take it very for granted that they can reach out to anybody whenever they want, that you should respond to them. There's a culture online now that never give in, you know, that there's no, nobody admits they were wrong. Nobody thinks through what they said. So, you know, you have to remember that when you don't know somebody, you can't know their pain or their insecurity or their rage or what makes them who they are. And so you're at a tremendous disadvantage in trying to have a productive conversation.
Your words remind me of Plato, who said, be kind to everyone, for they are carrying a heavy load. And you have no idea what that load is. I mean, you know, we have no idea.
No, that's right. It's something, you know, I think about more as you get older and you know more people and have more experiences. It's not easy being anybody out there. And yeah. I still can lose my, I can lose my temper for sure.
Sure.
And, you know, but I feel much worse about it than I did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for the other person, you know, not just for myself. I feel like you have to give people the opportunity to be wrong.
Yeah, it's the emotional residue that you feel is what I kind of surprised me. I didn't feel good about getting involved in a pointless argument with people for whom I should be having compassion in the first place. So it kind of deviated from my own personal standards.
Right, that's a good way to put it.
Point number 5, have the difficult conversation.
Yeah, I work on this. You know, I, like a lot of things on this list, I'm not perfect myself, but I do. There is a temptation. I'm sure it's true in business. It's true as a writer. It's true in life, and particularly now that we have all of these other kinds of communication. Because I, as a writer, email is very natural for me. I can say anything in email. There is a temptation to put off difficult conversations or send a note and hope that does it. Or you know, just basically avoid or have somebody else do it. You know, I have, like I said before, you get into a certain point in my business where you have agents and lawyers and they can do it, right? They're all, you know, you could say to your agent, well, you call them and tell them I don't want to do that thing anymore. But there's a value, I think I've decided in life, in having that tough conversation yourself and picking up the phone when your heart's beating a little fast and saying, this doesn't work for me, or, you know, and I think particularly when you see leaders in business or in other editors that I've had, other people who are supposed to lead organizations and institutions, mm-hmm. and if they're not willing to look you in the eye themselves and tell you why they feel they need to do a difficult thing, it's very hard to respect them. Mm-hmm. So I think pushing yourself to have the conversations you don't want to have in work, in relationships, in life, I think it's, you feel better about yourself and people will respect you more. And I almost, I experience this a lot as a journalist. Somebody's going to be mad at what you've written. You kind of want to tell them, hey, I wrote a piece, and you're going to be really upset about it. And you, it's tempting to email. It's tempting to just let them read it in the morning, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I find that I always feel better and I always preserve relationships better when I'm direct with people than when I do that myself. And I don't have all, I'm not batting 1,000, but I try to get better and better about it.
Well, the thing is that the reason we avoid those difficult conversations is we think it's going to be so hard. And in my experience, and this is based on good psychology, it's this hard, not this hard. And
usually,
and
right?
Yeah. I mean, it's usually much easier than you think. Yeah, you know, sometimes it's not, but then so you very quickly discover, so what?
Yeah, that's right. It's rarely as bad as you think it's going to be. It can be difficult, but putting it off or putting it on someone else is worse. You know, it goes back to, I guess, treating people the way you want to be treated, right? The oldest rule in the book. And I think most of us would rather have somebody level with them.
Mm-hmm. Point number 6, you'll have to explain this one to me. People always make you feel the way they feel.
So, yeah, I this is another one I talk to my kids about a lot. So, I was at Newsweek, so I was probably in my early 30s. I was traveling around all the time, and I was traveling from one city to another. And I met this woman on a plane, and she's a psychologist. And we got to talking, and as it turned out, as weird things happened, we spent some time together after. She was coming to the town where she was coming to Washington, where I was living. And she told me something as we were having this discussion. She said, well, the thing is, however people make you feel is generally how they're feeling themselves. So if they make you feel small, it's because the world makes them feel small. If they make you feel dumb, it's because the world is making them feel dumb. And it was such a simple formulation, and it's probably pretty standard for people who study the human psyche, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it's always stuck with me, and I found it to be very useful in life to remember. In fact, a tremendous example of that to me is President Trump, who I've written about this. I've written columns about this, you know, who, you know, makes our politics feel very small and trivial. Mm-hmm. And I think because he often feels small and trivial, has a fear of that. And so it's been very useful in dealing with people in difficult situations or just to help me remember that person is coming from a place of their own weakness, and not to take it as personally as I otherwise would.
I think there's a lot of truth to that psychologically. Now, I used to run psychotherapy groups in psychiatric hospitals, so
I didn't know that.
You know, I used to be dealing with some of the sickest of the sick in our society, and I think there is a lot of truth to that, is all I can say, because in a therapy group, people will, this actually ties in with some of the things you're saying, people will manifest their illnesses right there in the group for all to see, if you know what to look for and if you know mm-hmm. what interactions to look for. And really, if you think about it, how else can we be? You know, the way we feel inside must be manifest somehow on the exterior.
Hmm. Right, exactly.
People always make you feel the way they feel. Okay, I like that. I like that a lot. Point number 7, know what you don't know.
I guess I hit on this a little already, but I do. You know, it's just so tempting in life, and I see it in business too. I've seen it with organizations, news organizations. It's just so tempting to believe you can do everything, you can just know thing, you know how to do something that you just don't know how to do. And, you know, I think knowing your limits and knowing when to turn to experts is a really important thing. Somebody said to me just this past weekend, he said, you know, you can, I don't know, I was talking about putting in a thermostat in my house. He said, you can do that yourself. And I said, no, you know, I actually can't. I could, but it's going to go really badly. Like, I'm all for improving in self-education, but there are people who know how to do that, and I don't know how to do that. And so, you know, it's, I found that to be useful as a writer, you know, and particularly going into Hollywood, a business where I really don't know anything, you know, knowing when I'm talking to someone, whether it's about the deal part of something or even the production part of something, where I think, you know, this person really knows what they're talking about. I can tell them how I want it done, but chances are I'm mm-hmm. going to regret it. Mm-hmm. And so you know, a lot of life is common sense, and you know, you may know how to do things you don't think you know how to do, but it's not like those old Holiday Inn commercials, the Holiday Inn Express commercial. You know, are you a doctor? No, but I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night. Like, you know, you want the operation done by a surgeon, and you want your lawyering done by your lawyers. And I think, you know, just knowing your own limits, keeps you from making dumb mistakes.
Our producer, Rob, always likes to say, if you want bread, go to a baker. And the reason he says that is because his dad told him, if you want bread, go to a baker. And so, you know, go to somebody who does it full time, knows what they're doing. Sure, you can make your bread if you want, but, you know, to get it right. And I guess that's why, I mean, personally, that's why I have an accountant. That's why I have a dentist. That's why I have an orthopedic surgeon, because, you know, they know more about this stuff than me.
Well, and you see this on, you know, a friend of mine, a co-writer of mine, always likes to compare it to the pilot and the planes. It's like, you don't want me flying your plane, right? But you see this on, again, it goes back to cable TV or the internet, you know, as a practical application of it. You see these people talking about things they clearly don't know very well. Mm-hmm. And they look foolish, and then they're proven wrong. And sometimes, you know, whenever I do TV, I sometimes do a Sunday show, or I used to do more cable. I don't, as a rule, do cable TV, haven't for years. But you're tempted, I always tempted to say, yeah, I don't really know. You just ask me something I don't know. And they get very upset about that. They don't like that. But I think, you know, knowing when to say, I just don't know, is an important part of not looking like a buffoon. And I think people often learn that too late, if at all.
Yeah, if at all. Point number eight. No one really likes surprises. Well, I do, Matt. Well, it depends on what kind of surprise it is. Yes.
Yeah. What I mean by that is, you know, that is really a very, I'm making a really pragmatic observation, I think, at work, for work and business, and certainly for what I do, writing for editors or directors or whoever you're working for. It's, you can get away with a lot. You can reinterpret things. You can give people things they didn't know. You know, you can take an assignment and change it. You can, you know, present your boss with a whole different way of looking at a project than they may have thought. But my advice to people in a professional sense is don't surprise your superiors or your coworkers. You know, don't think that, I think people get this crazy idea they've gotten from like TV where they're going to like wow everybody. They're going to stand up in a meeting and say, well, I did this. I looked at this completely differently. I didn't do what you asked me to do. I did this amazing thing, and everyone's going to get up and cheer for them. I've always found that, just giving people a heads up of what you're doing can spare you a lot of headaches and get you a better hearing. You know, if I'm changing a story that I'm writing and doing something else, if I'm changing the way I've promised I'm going to do something, or I've decided to change a character in a screenplay, I'll send a note or get on the phone and say, hey, just so you know, because I am not turning this into you yet, but I've decided to do it this way, or I've decided to do it that way. And I think sometimes writers fear you're going to get a note back saying, don't do that. Right. I'm sure it works the same if you're working in a Fortune 500 company. You know, you don't want your boss to call you and say, no, don't do it that way. Do it my way. And you do run that risk. But I think if you surprise the people you work for, even if you've done great work, some number of bosses in the world are going to discount what you've done simply because it's not what they were expecting. And they're taken by, yeah, they're sort of back on their heels. So
you're talking about altering their expectations before you spring it on them.
Yeah, just keeping their expectations in the right place. Just making sure people know what you're doing, so that when you give them a product that you've written or you've put together, they can see it. And they're not just sitting there the whole time going, this isn't what I was expecting. This isn't what I asked for. Just communicating. It's just another way of saying just communicate with people. You may think they're going to love this. You're going to surprise and wow them like crazy, but the surprise usually doesn't work in your favor, is my experience.
I can certainly attest that business loves predictability. They very much so. They want to know what the interest rates are going to be. They want to know what the weather is going to be. They want to know. And so business talks a lot about disruption, you know, in a positive way, but
they
very much like status quo, predictability, you know, that's.
Yeah.
Number nine kind of says it all to me in some way. Choices are everything.
Yeah, choices are everything. I mean, this is a lesson in writing that's also true in life, but it's, you know, I learned it through writing, I think, more than anything. It's nothing, one choice may be better than the other. One may work out, one may not, but there's nothing worse than the failure to make tough choices. And that's true on a page. If you're writing, you know, if you don't want to go one direction or the other, you don't want to choose a character, you don't want to choose a storyline or a scene, you want to do everything, you're never not sure which is going to work better, so you just kind of abdicate. Mm-hmm. Then you just get a mess on the page, right? Because you haven't made the difficult choices. Writing is choosing. Governing mm-hmm. is choosing. That's literally the root of the word. And mm-hmm. we get bad governance when people don't want to choose between what the money they can bring in and the money they can spend, right? They don't want to choose one program over another. They want to have everything. And it's true just generally in life. I think, you know, when you're given opportunities or when you have a choice to make about what direction you want to go in your career and your life, I think there's an indecision is the thing that'll kill you. It's the thing that, you know, not being able to choose, letting, then you let other people choose for you. And this is the thing I always say to writing students is, well, you can take a piece that's supposed to be 3,000 words and turn it in at 5,000. I know writers who do this and just say, I can't get 2,000 words out of this piece. You know, I'll leave it to an editor. And that may work out for you, but because you couldn't make the choice, somebody else gets to. And they get control of your material and control of your ideas. And hard as it is to make that choice, it's always preferable to leaving the choice to somebody else. And I think a lot of us in life do punt on choices at key moments because it's so scary to have to live with the responsibility for them. And it's just always better to control your own destiny and control your own creative work and control your own career path. And so, you know, I think choosing means turning down things that you may regret, choosing to take paths that that may or may not work out, but you've mm-hmm. got to make those choices.
Every editor I met wants copy. They don't want hard work. I mean, you send them 5,000 words. And right. It's also true in music. What you're saying reminds me of Tony Williams, famous jazz drummer, and other drummers were commenting about his work. And they said they admired him because of the decisions he made, the choices he made. He played this note and this rhythm, this beat, instead of anything else you could have done. And that's what makes him so, well, what makes him great. He's a legendary jazz drummer.
I mean, I feel the same way about music, and I feel the same way about books and magazine stories. When I read, you know, a book that I think is great, or, you know, music, it's funny. Music is interesting because it used to require more choices. And now that you can just drop songs as much as you want, and there's no limit on time or tracks, mm-hmm. you can make fewer choices. But when I read a great book, that's the way I often describe it to myself. I would think, what great choices that writer made. You know, I just read Patrick Radden Keefe's book on the IRA and the troubles in Ireland called Say Nothing. Really brilliant book. And, you know, Patrick's a writer at The New Yorker. And I said to him, the book was terrific, but I said, you made great choices. Because it is, I see that when you read great writing that, oh, you've chosen this to follow this character. You've chosen not, you know, you can't follow everybody. Mm-hmm. And a series of good choices makes a great story, just like it makes a great album.
Well, let's use your book as an example. You wrote a book, and I don't know how many words it was, but then you condense into a screenplay. So let's say you have 1,000 scenes in your book, and you have to condense it down to 100 and maybe 150 yeah. scenes for a movie. So that's a lot of deciding right there.
It is, and they're very hard. Those are very hard choices to make. Mm. But you really have to do it. And it's hard, you know, stuff always ends up on the cutting room floor that you wish you had, but the movie that doesn't edit, right? We've all seen them. The movie that wants all of its footage. That's the one you can't stand to sit through. Right?
Show me the director's cut that's shorter than the original. I'm still waiting to see that, you know,
it's a failure to choose. You know, people go design houses, right? And they want everything. They want you want the deck and you want the pool and you want the lighting and you want the windows, and it's a mess, right? It's just, you know, so not, I don't get to design a house like that, but I see them. So, you know, I just think it's true almost, you know, for everything. It's certainly true in the people you know and choose to spend time with. And it's, everything is about those trade-offs, and the only way to control them is to make the choices.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere, a choice is like a cage, and you know, you're constraining yourself by what you choose, but that's okay, because if you're here, then you can't be there simultaneously. If you're doing this, you can't be doing that, at least not at the same time. If you right. marry this person, then you can't marry that person at the same time. It's illegal. And so if you write yeah. this, then you're not writing that. It just, so, and those are
exactly.
all, but it's all sort of taking, exercising your authority, taking responsibility, and being, this is my take on what you're saying, that being a mature, grown-up adult, I choose to do this and I'll live with the consequences.
Yeah. I mean, sure. I've said to magazine writers before, there's only two ways to do this. This magazine's really hard. You know, if you got a 10,000 word story and you worked on it for months, either the information can own you or you can wrestle the information down. You know, it's, you can either make the choices that are tough or you'll just get buried. And I think it's true in life too. It's exactly what you're saying.
Our 10th and final point. I have no idea where you're going with this, by the way. Number 10, look away from the ball.
So, yeah. Well, you know, I think about this a lot. So I had a professor, I was at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. I had Roger Rosenblatt, one of the great American essayists and writers, public broadcasting personality. And Roger was a great writing teacher, was a great writing professor. And he had a series of his own rules that he gave to writers in his class, not all of which I remember. But the one that really stuck out to me was look away from the ball. And it's sort of, you know, everybody, the crowd will always look in one place. Everybody will always go where the action is. There's always something interesting happening on the periphery. And the classic journalism case of this is, I think it was Jimmy Breslin, who's sent to cover the assassination of John Kennedy and the ensuing ceremonies, and finds the gravedigger who's digging the grave for Kennedy and does this, you know, beautiful story. About the gravedigger. It's just a classic case of looking away from the ball. But I think it's as true in life as it is in writing. And I think that's why it stuck with me so much and why I think about it, because, there is this mass thinking all the time. Everybody always goes to the same place. Everybody looks at the main action. You know, it happens in journalism, it happens in Hollywood, it happens in business. Everybody wants to look at, you know, the thing of the moment. And I think the real visionaries, I think the people who achieve unusual things, look away from the action and think, you know, what's happening over there? What's coming next? You know, what aren't we noticing? And so I think as a general rule in life, you know, if you, as a way of not following wherever the crowd or the conventional wisdom is, I think looking away from the ball is pretty good advice.
What else can we attend to that is not the bleeding obvious, is my interpretation of what you're saying.
Exactly. There's just too much of that, you know, and I thought that as a columnist, I certainly try, you know, I really, as soon as there's a giant event that everybody's writing about, I've always tended to shy away from that. Sometimes I'm asked or I have an idea and I'll dive into it. Sometimes I'm happy I did, but my first instinct is always to move away and look somewhere else, because if everybody's looking in one place, they're missing something important. And you can carve out a real niche for yourself, a place for yourself, looking in a different direction.
Okay, we'll finish there with 10 lessons it took Matt By 50 years to learn. You've been listening to the international podcast of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Today's episode is produced by Robert Hosry and sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, parties, anything you want, everything you need. You can find it on professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Best of all, everything's free. Thank you for listening to us today. Please join us for the next episode of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, Shortcuts to Excellence.